is Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Hopefully, you're smack dab in the middle of a lovely, long July 4th weekend. And just possibly, you're thinking about a longer summer getaway, am I right? In the spirit of Wanderlust, I've researched a show to get you dreaming of far-flung locales. My guest today has a new travel book that seems to be written just for us. Okay, there's lots of this travel show to pack in, so let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Edward Rutherford has enchanted millions of readers with his broad, multi-generational dramas of history's great achievements and travails. On the literary radar now is his Paris, the novel, a sweeping saga of love, war, art, and intrigue in the City of Light. Moving back and forth in time across centuries, the story unfolds through vivid tales of self-discovery, divided loyalties, passion, and long-kept secrets of characters, both fictional and real. It's all here, from the building of Notre Dame to the glittering court of Versailles, and from the violence of the French Revolution to the French Resistance in World War II and the student riots of the 1960s. Based on meticulous research, Rutherford weaves an extraordinary narrative tapestry, capturing the core of the magic city. Jean Gilpin narrates.
Old Paris, city of bright colors and narrow streets, of carnival and plague. And then there was new Paris. The change had come slowly. From the time of the Renaissance, lighter, classical spaces began to appear in her dark medieval mass. Royal palaces and noble squares created a new splendor. Broad boulevards began to carve through the rotting old warrens. Ambitious rulers created vistas worthy of ancient Rome. Paris had altered her face to suit the magnificence of Louis XIV and the elegance of Louis XV. The Age of Enlightenment and the new Republic of the French Revolution had encouraged classical simplicity, and the Age of Napoleon bequeathed imperial grandeur. Recently, this process of change had been accelerated by a new town planner. Baron Haussmann's great network of boulevards and long, straight streets lined with elegant office and apartment blocks were so thorough that there were quarters of Paris now where the rich mess of the Middle Ages was scarcely to be seen. Yet old Paris was still there, around almost every corner, with her memories of centuries past and of lives relived. Memories as haunting as an old half-forgotten tune that when played again, in another age, in another key, whether on harp or hurdy-gurdy, is still the same. This was her enduring grace. Was Paris now at peace with herself? She had suffered and survived, seen empires rise and fall, chaos and dictatorship, monarchy and republic. Paris had tried them all. And which did she like best? Ah, There was a question. For all her age and grace, it seemed she did not know. Recently, she had suffered another terrible crisis. 4 years ago, her people had been eating rats. Humiliated first, starving next. Then they had turned upon each other. It had not been long since the bodies had been buried, the smell of death being dispersed by the wind, and the echo of the firing squads departed over the horizon. Now, in the year 1875, she was recovering. But many great issues remained still to be resolved. The little boy was only 3, a fair-haired, blue-eyed child. Some things he knew already. Others were still kept from him. And then there were the secrets. Father Xavier gazed at him. How like his mother the child looked. Father Xavier was a priest, but he was in love with a woman, the mother of this child. He admitted his passion to himself, but his self-discipline was complete. No one would have guessed his love. As for the little boy, God surely had a plan for him. Perhaps that he should be sacrificed. It was a sunny day in the fashionable Tuileries Gardens in front of the Louvre, where nannies watched their children play, and Father Xavier was taking him for a walk. Father Xavier, family confessor, friend in need.
We've just heard Paris, the novel, by Edward Rutherford. Terry Peterson Smith is a journalist and editor. Her work has been featured in Better Homes and Gardens, National Geographic Green Guide, ScientificAmerican.com, and more. Terry writes about an incredible array of subjects and people, from dismantling bombs in the former USSR to Broadway shows and potential cures for cancer. She was a recipient of the Michael DeBakey Journalism Award from the Foundation for Biomedical Research. Her new book, Off the Beaten Page, The Best Trips for Lit Lovers, Book Clubs, and Girls on Getaways, was inspired by her love of reading and her love of travel. The book describes 15 U.S. destinations and is an exploration of places where literature and travel intersect. Welcome, Terry. Thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Oh, I'm so happy to be with you.
Tell us more about literary travel.
Well, literary travel basically is travel inspired by and centered on works of literature. So read the book, go where it takes place. It's that simple. It offers a way to experience the intersection between the real place and the fictional story. So I call that going off the beaten page. And it's what people take lit trips for the same reason that they go to Civil War battlefields or take art trips to see where a painter painted a famous painting. It gives you a closer connection. It's sort of interesting because in many ways, the two, literature, reading and travel, enhance each other, kind of, I always say, like wine in a great meal. So as a reader, it extends the experience of a book, and really no matter how great a job the writer did creating a sense of place, it adds a whole new dimension when you can actually go there and see the landscape and smell the smells and feel the humidity and things like that. And as a traveler, I think literature in Off the Beaten Page has both fiction and nonfiction. It gives you a little bit of a leg up in understanding your destination, and it helps you anticipate the trip. It helps kind of cut through a lot of the sameness. In this country, in particular, you can go to so many places and the freeway looks the same, the airport looks the same, chain stores and shops. And with literary travel, you can get past all that and really experience a place. It's sort of interesting, too, because fiction, more than a straight travel, guidebook, can layer and distill and give you the essence of a place in the way that, that other types of reading can't. It was interesting because Dennis Lehane was speaking here a couple of weeks ago, and you're probably familiar with him. He wrote Mystic River and does a lot of writing, crime writing around the Boston area.
Right.
And one thing he said really struck me. He said, fiction is the lie that tells the truth, and that really grabbed me. And so it really makes, it's really cool to read a book and then go to the place.
Right. You know, I love the way your book was formatted. Talk about that.
There are two sections to the book. One is a basic introduction to the idea of literary travel, which has been going on since the early 19th century in England. People used to ride around in their carriages and, you know, see sights of Sir Walter Scott and things like that. And now there are just many, many more places where you can go and make that connection. In fact, I've been reading about how Dan Brown's new book that's coming out, The Inferno, which takes place in Florence, has all the tour guides excited there.
Right.
Taking their Dan Brown tour. But so the beginning of the book has about literary travel, a section on how, a chapter on how to avoid a temperamental journey. So you can come back for your trip as good of friends as when you left, which isn't always easy with a group. So how to plan a trip, and then a little bit about ideas for doing lit trips like field trips close to home to kind of get your feet wet with this. And the rest of the book consists of 15 chapters, each on a different destination across the U.S. that has a terrific literary connection and, you know, a lot of fun stuff to do in that area in addition to the literary side of it. So each chapter has an essay that ties a couple of books with the city to create a theme or a focus for the trip, and there are pretty extensive reading lists, itineraries, and then a short profile of an author who works in that area.
Okay. I've visited both Jack Kerouac's house in Orlando and Jane Austen's home in England. Both surprised me in very different ways. They're not at all what I expected. Describe one or two of your favorite experiences where being on the spot really impacted you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always love Santa Fe. There's a ton of stuff to do there, and that trip in Off the Beaten Page is tied to Willa Cather's book Death Comes for the Archbishop. And it almost made me laugh because I could go to so many places that are written about in the book. The book was practically, even though it's pretty much a fiction book, it was just you could actually see the Archbishop's peach tree. I mean, the real things are there that she based it on. So that was quite fun. But the place that probably most surprised and impressed me was Memphis. I had never been there before, and I chose that city because I wanted to go to a place that tied in with Mark Twain and where you could actually get out on the Mississippi River in a paddleboat and experience the river, the power of it, how difficult it is to navigate, all the things that he talks about in Life in the on the Mississippi and Huckleberry Finn and those sorts of things. But then when I got there, that was very impressive. But then when I got there, I started to understand better the impact of the river on the economy and the cotton industry. After the Civil War, the freed slaves started moving north in what became the Great Migration, which Twain mentions in Life on the Mississippi. Those people brought their musical, the spiritual and gospel traditions, which evolved into the Memphis Blues. And there you are, right on Beale Street. And there's some great books about all that. And then at the same time, Memphis was ground zero, I think, in the civil rights struggle. And when you read a book called Hellhound on His Trail by Hampton Sides about the assassination of Martin Luther King, and then actually go to the Civil Rights Museum, which is based at the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was assassinated, and actually see these places, you get such an understanding of what happened and the gravity of it and the tragedy. It gives you chills. So there was a lot going on in Memphis.
Right. Is there an optimum size for a travel group?
I guess I would say 8 to 10 would be ideal if you're going with a group. Of course, you can do this by yourself on a business trip. You know, take a little chunk of one of these itineraries and see whatever you have time for. But I think 8 to 10 is great. You could do a larger group, but it would take that much more planning, of course, to accommodate, say, 15 people at a restaurant or, you know, to get tickets to an event for that many people. Some of that stuff I discuss in the book, in that chapter on how to plan a trip. The good thing about a bit larger group is you can get discounts, you know, group discounts at museums, or sometimes they will even design a tour around you if you have a big enough group. So there are trade-offs, but I think it gets a little more cumbersome, just takes a little more planning for a bigger group.
Right. Any plans for an international edition?
Oh, I would love to do that. We'll see how this one goes, but a lot of people have said, are you going to go to the British Isles? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
England and Ireland. That would be a perfect follow-up to this book. I did want to focus on this country first, though, because there are so many exciting places, and it's like little, many little countries in one. And once you start looking at the literature in this country, there it's just so diverse. It's as diverse as the people, you know, between the, you know, Texas and Seattle and Charleston. I mean, everything's so different. It's very exciting and accessible in a long weekend. That was one of the ways I selected these cities, was ease of getting there. But yes, the British Isles would be great. I totally encourage people to do a little travel this way. It doesn't have to be expensive. You can do something in your own city even and see things in a totally new way.
All right. Well, Terry, I really enjoyed your book. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Elaine.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
Orhan Pamuk was born in Istanbul and still lives in the family apartment of his youth. His portrait of his city, Istanbul, Memories and the City, is also a self-portrait shaped by memory and melancholy. Pamuk moves from his glamorous, unhappy parents to the gorgeous, decrepit mansions overlooking the Bosphorus. He brilliantly explores the dawning of his self-consciousness shaped by the writers and painters who call the city their home. Like Joyce's Dublin or Borges' Buenos Aires, Pamuk's Istanbul is a triumphant encounter of place and sensibility, beautifully written and immensely moving. John Lee performs the title.
From the middle of the 19th century, as a string of military defeats was eroding the empire, the old city was swamped by immigrants, and even the grandest imperial buildings began to show marks of poverty and ruin. It became fashionable for the pashas and dignitaries of the modern Western-influenced bureaucracy to take refuge in the mansions they had built along the Bosphorus, where they set about creating a new culture that shut out the world. Western travelers could not penetrate this closed society. There were no paved roads. Even after ferries arrived in the mid-19th century, the Bosphorus did not become part of the city proper, and the Ottomans, ensconced in their Bosphorus mansions, chose not to write about their lives, so we must rely on memoirs of their sons and grandsons. The brightest of these memoirists is Abdul Haq Shinasi Hisar, 1887 to 1963, whose Bosphorus civilization is studded with long sentences of a Proustian sensibility. Hisar, who grew up in a Rumeli Hisar Yala, spent part of his youth in Paris and was friends with the poet Yahya Kemal, 1884 to 1958, with whom he studied political science. In Bosphorus Moonscapes and Bosphorus Yalas, he tried to recreate the mysterious allure of his vanishing culture by weaving and working it with all the care and attention of an old-time miniaturist. He wrote of their daytime rituals and their nighttime idylls, when they would gather in caiques to gaze at the silver moonlight playing on the water and savor the music wafting across the sea from a distant rowboat. I cannot pick up his Bosphorus moonscapes without a distinct sorrow at never having had the chance to witness its passions and its silences at first hand, and I enjoy seeing how this writer's intense nostalgia almost blinds him to the dark and evil undercurrents of his lost paradise. On moonlit nights, when the rowboats gathered in a still patch of sea and the musicians fell silent, even Esh Hisar felt them. When there is not a breath of wind, The waters sometimes shudder as if from inside and take on the finish of washed silk. On the rowboat with my mother, it seemed to me that the colours of the Bosphorus Hills were not reflections of an external light. The Judas and plane trees, the wings of the gulls that would flap so rapidly past us, and the half-broken walls of the boathouses, all of them glowed with a dim light that seemed to come from within. Even on the hottest days, when poor children jump from the shore road into the sea, the sun here is not in total command of the landscape. On summer evenings, when the reddening sky merges with the dark mysteries of the Bosphorus, the water foams, dragging madly after the rowboats cutting through it. But right beside the foam there is a smoother part of the sea whose colours do not change so much as undulate, like Monet's pool of water lilies. In the mid-60s, while studying at Robert Academy, I spent a great deal of time standing in the aisle of the crowded Besiktas Sarıyer bus, looking over to the hills on the Asian shore and watching as the Bosphorus, glimmering like a mysterious sea, changed colour with the sunrise. On misty spring evenings, when not a leaf in the city is rustling, on windless, noiseless summer nights, when a man walking alone after midnight along the Bosphorus shore can hear only the sound of his own footsteps, a moment will arrive as he is walking around Akunta Burnu, the point just beyond Arnavutköy, or as he reaches the lighthouse at the foot of the Asheyan Cemetery, when he hears the happy roar of the current and notices with apprehension the gleaming white foam that seems to have come from nowhere, and he cannot help but wonder, as A. Esh Hisar once did, and as I too have done, whether the Bosphorus has a soul. To see the cypress trees, the dark woods in the valleys, the empty and neglected yalas, and the old weathered ships with their rusty hues and mysterious cargoes, to see, as only those who have spent their lives on these shores can, the poetry of the Bosphorus ships and yalas, to discard historical grievances and enjoy it as fully as a child, to long to know more about this world, to understand it. This is the awkward surrender to uncertainty that a 50-year-old writer has come to know as pleasure.
We've just heard Istanbul, Memories and the City by Orhan Pamuk. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Of course, visiting one of our national parks is a favorite summer getaway. The Book Report is pleased to present Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks by Andrea Lankford. For 12 years, Lankford lived in the national parks, working a job she loved. She chaperoned baby sea turtles on their journey to the sea. She pursued bad guys on horse patrol. She jumped into rescue helicopters bound for the heart of the Grand Canyon. She won arguments with bears, and she slept with a few too many rattlesnakes. The book is the story behind the scenery of Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, the Great Smokies, and Denali. It's a graphic and surprisingly funny account of an extraordinary career. Lankford unveils a world where park rangers face the challenges of protecting the park from the people from the park, and the people from each other. Julia Motka narrates.
For 12 years, I lived and worked in some of the most sublime places in the world. Zion, Yosemite, and the Grand Canyon were all landscapes I was proud to protect. I participated in search and rescues, wildland firefighting, and law enforcement. I directed traffic around tarantula jams. I pursued bad guys while galloping on horseback. I jumped into rescue helicopters bound for the dark heart of the Grand Canyon and plucked the damned from the jaws of the abyss. I raced the sunset. I won arguments with bears. I dodged lightning bolts. I put on forest fires. I slept with a few too many rattlesnakes. Hell yeah, it was the best job in the world. And fortunately, I survived it. One of my dearest friends was not so lucky. Park rangers bring to mind images fit for a postcard. A square-jawed outdoorsman wearing a stiff-brimmed Stetson rides horseback through lonely canyons. A freckle-faced young woman hikes to an altar of wildflowers under a shadowy cathedral of redwoods. A friendly guy stands on the porch of a hewn log ranger station and waves to the happy campers passing by. These sylvan scenes make for pretty portraits of a ranger's life, but as every park ranger eventually learns, sunny postcards tell only half a story. Even paradise has its problems. Criminals go on vacation, too. In the United States, a park ranger is more likely to be assaulted in the line of duty than is any other federal officer, including those who work for the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, the Secret Service, and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. A park ranger is 12 times more likely to die on the job than is a special agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI. In light of such numbers, some describe park rangers, like grizzly bears, wild orchids, and sea turtles, as endangered. Within these pages, you will meet a few of the park rangers behind these statistics and read some of the stories behind the scenery of America's national parks. If my imaginary postcards were actual portraits of real park rangers I came to know and love during my intense and extraordinary career, the square-jawed outdoorsman would be Chris Fors, a hardy New Englander who used his sturdy expression to hide the fear and disillusionment he faced while working at the Grand Canyon. The freckle-faced young woman hiking through the trees would resemble Mary Littell, a rock climber determined to break the glass ceiling at Yosemite Valley. And the friendly ranger with a kind wave and goofy smile? That would be Cale Schaffer, a short guy with a big dream, to become a mountaineering ranger on Denali, North America's tallest mountain. I cherish the memories I have of working alongside park rangers like Chris, Mary, and Cale. For better and worse, our time with the National Park Service, NPS, changed us in ways we could never have anticipated. In the beginning, we were four passionately dedicated rangers, willing to risk our lives to protect the national park ideal. But age wreaked havoc on our idealism. A little courage bled from each tragic experience, and hope seemed elusive when so many lives were lost. In the end, I watched someone toss a beloved ranger's ashes into the Grand Canyon. Rangers rarely share their experiences with those outside the clannish NPS. Chief rangers and park superintendents have politically fragile careers. NPS public information officers are reticent about the darker sides of the park experience. Concessionaires, multi-million-dollar companies that run the hotels, restaurants, and gift shops inside national parks, think bad news equals bad business. Park rangers, including those at the highest ranks, have been disciplined, frivolously indicted, and even fired because they told the truth about living, working, and dying in a national park. This is a work of nonfiction. The park rangers are real people. The stories are true.
That was Ranger Confidential by Andrea Langford. Staying in a hotel this summer? Before you check in, you may want to check out this eye-opener from Jacob Tomsky. The author worked in hotels for more than a decade, doing everything from valet parking to the front desk. He's welcomed you, separated your white undies from the white bedsheets, parked your car, tasted your room service, and eaten M&Ms from your minibar. In Heads and Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality, Tomsky, who narrates, pulls back the covers on the hospitality business, revealing the crazy yet compelling reality of the industry. It's an incredibly funny, authentic, and reverent chronicle of the highs and lows of hotel life. But Heads in Beds is more than just a memoir. Tomsky explains the secrets of the industry, offering easy legal ways to get you what you need from your hotel without any hassle, from scoring late check-ins and upgrades to getting that pay-per-view charge knocked off your bill.
Are you seriously drinking a mudslide? Chip asks. I use a car key from the box to vanish the bill completely and post up next to Chip, back in the sun. The shift boss sinks back into the shade. Chip says, I am way too old for this. Sharing tips? 40% to management leaves 60% of the tips to us, divided over 20 runners, on a check, with taxes taken out, and guess who's running the math? Guess who's counting up the tips? A grown man drinking a mudslide. He must have been talking to himself previously, because now Chip turned to me. You think he's going to turn in that 20? Or just keep it for himself? We never get good tips out here. You know what I heard? There's a new hotel opening up downtown. You heard that? It's supposed to be luxury. He said the word as if it were mystical and perhaps too good for his own tongue. Luxury. And they're looking for Parkers. Copeland's customers don't tip for... Chip, with a wide smile, accepts a claim check from an emerging lunch customer and locates the keys in the box. It's a f***ing Mazda, dude, he says quietly to me, and then to the customer. You won't be long in this heat, sir. I will run for your vehicle. Then he takes off sprinting. It's almost vaudevillian how he tears around the corner, his body at full tilt. Chip cruises the Mazda back in record time, gliding up to the curb. AC running and classic rock on low for you, sir. The customer drops something into his cupped palm, something that makes Chip's face contort. Chip stands upright, essentially blocking the customer from entering his own vehicle, and spreads open his palm to let the two-quarter tip flash in the sun. With a voice strained and tight, as if he were suffering intense physical pain, he says, "Why, thank you so very much, sir." Then he pivots slightly and extends his hand, palm flat, quarters in the sun again. Then he drop kicks both coins, kicks the shit out of them into the street. They arc over the road and land on the rough grass of the neutral ground, settling in before a streetcar rocks by. I can see the shock on the customer's face, the confusion, the horror. Chip just walks off with determination, crossing St. Charles and onto the neutral ground. After picking the quarters out of the grass, he crosses the tracks to the far side of the street and starts bearing down Napoleon Avenue toward mid-city. The job, the restaurant, the shift boss, me, all of us in his rearview mirror. I finished my shift. Then I took his advice about the hotel job. Whether I knew it yet or not, it was one hell of an important moment for me, watching Chip snap at what seemed like such a minor affront. Seeing that much emotion applied to a single low-quality tip. And then watching him bend down, fish the quarters out of the dirt, and take them with him. I didn't understand any of it. Not yet. Here we go. Hotel orientation. Human resources pretty much hired everyone. Everyone who passed the drug test. I passed, thank you. Chip did not. The River Hotel, connected to a brand known for luxury, known for being out of almost everyone's price range, was being built right there on Charter Street in downtown New Orleans. It was 3 weeks from opening and still under construction. Yet they hired us all, tailored our uniforms, and started paying us. A week ago, I was earning money and giving it to an idiot who pounds mudslides. Now I wasn't even working, but I was collecting a check, a good check, and no one had even said the word valet yet. Not that our new managers weren't saying any words. Honestly, they couldn't stop saying some words. Service, luxury, honesty, loyalty, opulence, and mid-length phrases such as customer feedback and anticipating needs. And then longer, million-dollar phrases like 1,500 thread-count Egyptian linen duvet covers. Management ran classes every day on service, administered in the completed conference rooms, the tables draped with what we assumed to be Egyptian fabric and adorned with ice carafes of water, which we poured into crystal goblets to wash down the huge piles of pastries they fed us.
That was a sampling of Heads and Beds by Jacob Tomsky. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Years, 11 countries, 1,200 families, 14,000 kilometers. These are the adventures in the footsteps of mankind through the cradle of life. Authors and adventurers Alexander and Sonia Poisson walked the length of Africa entirely on foot, from the Cape of Good Hope to the Sea of Galilee. Africa Trek Volume 1 chronicles their three-year journey along the Great Rift Valley of East Africa. Their goal was to symbolically retrace the passage of early man, from Australopithecus to modern man. Without sponsors or a support team, the authors shared the poverty of their hosts and the generosity and enthusiasm of the African men and women. In this volume, which recounts the first 7,000 kilometers up to Mount Kilimanjaro, readers get an intimate look into the heart of Africa and her people. Victor Bevine narrates.
As it turns out, it is towards the Stellenbosch and Franschhoek vineyards that we resume our trek. Planted by Huguenots, who were expelled after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685, their Merlot, Cabernet, and Pinotage vines, a local varietal, are exposed to the Cape Doctor, a local wind, and to the ferocious sun, yielding wines so robust that you sometimes have the feeling you are drinking port. We enter Stellenbosch, the university town of 10,000 oaks. Small, squat, whitewashed churches hold pride of place in parks where fathers initiated their offspring into the mysteries of cricket. Founded in 1680, this was the first town of the interior, laid out with lovely lanes lined with centuries-old Cape Dutch cottages at street level, their gables and verandas festooned with ancient wisteria. Thatched roofs, too, a feeling of a quiet Europe, and then there are those eternal oaks stretching forever. We meet a young French aristocrat, Stéphane de Saint-Salvi, an enologist who has come to South Africa to marry a de Villiers, an Afrikaner family that was French three centuries back, and to give a French touch to the Spear wines, a famous local vintage. The cycle is completed. They live outside of the city in a small house built in 1781. Stéphane is a bit of a dreamer, contemplatively wreathed in the smoke of his cigarette. And Karine is a hyperactive blonde with big liquid blue eyes. That night, they initiate us into a mandatory ritual. The braai, the South African version of barbecue, which is taken very seriously here. You know, a kilo of T-bone steak costs here between 3 and 4 euros. It would be a sin not to have some. Turning the meat over, he goes on. The ideal would be to work 6 months here, 6 months in France. 2 grape harvests, thanks to the seasons being reversed. The label on the bottle, as if to celebrate the theme of our trek, displays a large Acheulean hand axe, a cut prehistoric stone tool. This is my neighbor Reinecke's wine. He's discovered many Paleolithic tools among his vines. The Cape region was inhabited by hunter-gatherers more than 30,000 years ago. Let that be a reminder to all, whites and blacks, who think that they got here first. Historians call these people the Strandlopers. they lived on the beaches, subsisting mainly on shellfish. They are no doubt the ancestors of the Hottentots, the Griquas, and the Khoisans who inhabited the peninsula. The next morning we walked towards Franschhoek, the French Corner, crossing farms and vineyards with a motherland feeling in the air. Languedoc, La Cigale, La Petite Ferme, La Rochelle, Ma Normandie. A valley of marvels, bordered by the Drachenstein Mountains. That evening, David de Villiers, Karine's younger brother, comes to pick us up along the route. We're going to sleep at his house, the historic old family farm built by a settler ancestor who came here in 1688. David has just taken over the farm, which was abandoned for quite a while. A heavy responsibility. The house, which looks out onto the valley, is nestled among huge trees. Peacocks cry in the setting sun, and gaggles of guinea hens come out of the abandoned prairies, cackling noisily. The flaking shutters yawn with fatigue. The columns of the loggia bend beneath the weight of years and nostalgia for past grandeur. Inside, history is covered in dust, and obsolete objects speak of previous generations, but they are all orphans, juxtaposed on sideboards in credenzas like Aboli bibelot d'inanité sonore. Outside, the crickets have begun their nocturnal serenade. Everything has the sad beauty of passing time. Gone with the wind.
That was Africa Trek by Alexandra and Sonia Poisson. In May 2007, Car 84 left China's Great Wall, one of 128 antique autos racing in the Peking to Paris Motor Challenge. This particular vehicle was guided by one Dina Bennett, a daydreamer prone to car sickness, riddled with self-doubt, and married to a thrill-seeking perfectionist who was half-human, half-race car. What could possibly go wrong? Funny and self-deprecating, Peking to Paris, life and love and a short drive around half the world is first and foremost a voyage of transformation. Starting in Beijing, Dina and her husband Bernard limp across the Gobi, Siberia, Baltic States, and south to Paris in a 1940 Cadillac LaSalle. Writing for every woman who's ever doubted herself, and for any man who's wondering what the woman on the passenger side is thinking, Dina brings the reader with her as she earns the title Dashboard Diva. Catherine Dyer narrates.
It never occurred to me that I would spend so much time in a car, any car. And in places a GPS has to think twice about pinpointing. I'm just not suited to this. I get carsick. I live in a perpetual state of anxiety. And I hate not knowing what comes next. I've done a lot of things in life because I didn't think carefully enough beforehand. Didn't know how to turn tail and run. When I'm in trouble, I rue this major defect in my character. Once I'm out of trouble, I thank goodness for my ability to use fantasy to pull me into escapades for which I'm utterly unsuited. Without that ability, what follows could never have happened. We've barely set foot in China, and already I'm feeling the familiar twinge of panic that I might get lost. Knowing how to find my way is a skill of more than ordinary importance to me. In a matter of days, we'll be idling at the Great Wall in a 70-year-old vehicle and waiting for a checkered flag to wave downward, releasing us on a 7,800-mile car race to Place Vendôme in Paris. My husband, Bernard, will be driving. And as for the next 35 days, I'll be telling him where to go. At the moment, I am plowing my way through the crush of people jostling to meet arrivals at Beijing Capital International Airport. I walk as my mother taught me when, as a small girl, I struggled behind her, bucking the rush hour crowds in New York's Grand Central Station. "Put your hands on your hips, darling," she said in her lilting French accent. "Comme ça." Her manicured hands placing mine properly, so my elbows stuck out. When people are too close, just poke them, she told me, tossing her head with laughter at her own daring. The trick worked for her, but I suspect it had nothing to do with arm placement, and all to do with her glamour and perfume. I was 5 years old. My head barely reached the average commuter's waist. No one gave way for me, leaving me struggling to keep up, face reddening with panic, rubbing my bruised elbows. Here in Beijing, my mother's crowd-tamer trick is once again deficient. Buffeted by hordes of happy greeters, I watched Bernard swiveling his hips through the mass of people like a retreating rumba dancer. So sure is he that he's breaking trail for me, helping me along, that he doesn't even glance back to see I'm falling further and further behind. To keep my carry-on bag from sliding off my shoulder, I scrunch my neck to keep the strap in place. But my neck, already cocked at an odd angle from 18 hours in a plane, refuses to maintain the position. The bag, loaded with maps, chargers, a handful of my favorite Lemon Luna bars, and a Radio Shack worth of spare batteries, slams to the floor. I stop to readjust, looking up just in time to make out Bernard as he dodges into a small taxi. By the time I duck in beside him, I'm a sweaty mess. I'm also a happy mess, ready for the relief offered by this safe, though sadly too temporary, mobile haven. Despite being jet-lagged, with eyes shriveled to hard little raisins from too many hours on a plane, there's one thing I do notice. There are a lot of people here. More people in one square block than in the entire 2,400 square miles of my Colorado county, where the resident population barely breaks 1,400 souls on a day when everybody gets out of bed. Millions are going about their business as our taxi driver wends his way through traffic, stopping now and then to let a flood of pedestrians flow across the clogged streets. When a gap appears at the curb, new pedestrians swarm to fill it, backed by countless more. Peering through the window, I alternate between stunned gratitude that I'm here and a fretful anxiety at what this implies. Everywhere are street signs in Mandarin, a language I've been unable to learn.
We've just heard Peking to Paris by Dina Bennett. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. From the heart of China into the mountains of Central Asia, across northern Afghanistan and the plains of Iran into Kurdish Turkey, Colin Thubron undertakes a journey along one of the great land routes in Shadow of the Silk Road. Traveling 7,000 miles in 8 months, he traces the passage of trade and armies, of ideas, religions, and inventions. With a gift for talking to others and of getting them to talk to him, Thubron meets fascinating people and crosses borders of tribe, ethnicity, language, and religion for a fascinating glimpse into some of the most remote places on Earth. Jonathan Keeble narrates.
I think of saying Turkey, the Mediterranean, but it sounds preposterous. I hear myself answer, along the Silk Road, to the northwest, to Kashgar. And this sounds strange enough. She smiles nervously. She feels she has already reached out too far and turns silent. But the unvoiced question, why are you going, gathers between her eyes in a faint, perplexed fleur-de-lis. This why in China is rarely asked. It is too intrusive, too internal. We walk in silence. Sometimes a journey arises out of hope and instinct. the heady conviction as your finger travels along the map. Yes, here and here and here. These are the nerve ends of the world. 100 reasons clamour for your going. You go to touch on human identities, to people an empty map. You have a notion that this is the world's heart. You go to encounter the protean shapes of faith. You go because you are still young and crave excitement, the crunch of your boots in the dust. You go because you are old and need to understand something before it's too late. You go to see what will happen. Yet to follow the Silk Road is to follow a ghost. It flows through the heart of Asia, but it has officially vanished, leaving behind it the pattern of its restlessness. Counterfeit borders, unmapped peoples. The road forks and wanders wherever you are. It is not a single way, but many. A web of choices. Mine stretches more than 7,000 miles and is occasionally dangerous. But in the Temple of the Yellow Emperor, the woman's gaze has drifted north. "He was buried up here, on the mountain," she says. "It's written that people tugged at the Emperor's clothes as he flew to heaven, trying to pull him back. Some say that only his clothes are buried there, but I don't think this is true." She speaks softly, with a tinge of unexplained sadness. "The grave is quite small, not like those of later emperors. I think life was simpler in those days." We walk for a minute longer, under the eaves of the temple. Then suddenly, the quiet is shattered by the stutter of power drills and the groan of dump trucks. "They're building the new temple," she says, "for celebrations and conferences. This one's too small. The new one will hold 5,000 people." Later, I peer down from the hillside on the building site where it will be. I imagine the stressless, unchanging temple pavilions of China rising from their wan granite. This place, Huangling, is only 100 miles north of modern Xi'an, but is lost deep in another time of erosion and poverty. Who will come? But the whole site is resurrecting as a national shrine, and already the older temple is filled with the memorial stelae of China's statesmen, offering homage to the father of the nation. Here is the stone calligraphy of Sun Yat-sen from 1912, and of Chiang Kai-shek, predictably coarse, of Mao Zedong, who was later to condemn the Yellow Emperor as feudal, of Deng Xiaoping and the hated Li Peng. The clamour of restoration dies as you climb the track where it snakes through the cypress woods. From somewhere sounds the drilling of a woodpecker, and human voices echo and fade above you. Here and there a yellow flag on a bamboo pole marks the way. You are sinking back in time. Close to the summit, the path becomes a stone stairway, and the trees turn phantasmal, their trunks twisted like sticks of barley sugar or wrenched open on swirling slate-blue veins. Here, the grandest mandarin, even the emperor, abandoned his sedan chair and approached the mausoleum on foot. For there is little in the end, from music to the calendar, whose discovery is not attributed to the Yellow Emperor. He reigned for 100 years, until 2597 BC, before ascending to heaven on a dragon. It was he who instituted the festivals of earth and silk. After him, the reigning emperors, from a remote time, inaugurated the year by ploughing a ritual furrow.
That was a sampling of Shadow of the Silk Road by Colin Thubron. And as you contemplate your summer travels, imagine a 7,000-mile journey from the glitzy streets of Paris to the hinterland of northwestern Africa. To Dakar and back, 21 days across North Africa by motorcycle, by Lawrence Hacking and Will de Klerk, chronicles one of the most arduous and notorious off-road motorsports events on the planet, the Paris-Dakar Rally. Since its inception in 1979, the rally has attracted more than 3,000 participants from all walks of life and is considered to be one of the world's top five adventures. Mike Chamberlain narrates.
I awoke in a daze, listless and disoriented. Harsh sunlight streamed through the tent walls, nearly blinding my eyes. It seemed like I had dreamt the whole night, that I was struggling through the desert on my bike, on foot, and even on camelback. I'd had very little sleep, and I didn't want to get up. I could have used a blast of smelling salts to shake me out of my stupor, but I knew I had to persevere and tackle the next stage. It was not a good frame of mind to be in to take on 535 kilometers of African desert. Everyone was in agreement that stage 13, of which 513 clicks was competitive, would be one of the toughest ever seen in Dakar. But toughest, like worse, is a relative term. I didn't want to think that anything could be tougher than what I had just endured. The route we were to follow looped from Tijika and back. It was the second of the marathon legs, in which no assistance from chase trucks was permitted. Not that that meant much to the privateers who had no team infrastructure to assist them in the first place. Once the special kicked off, we would have to navigate our way through a pass over a cliff, run along the base of the cliff, and climb back up on the plateau through the infamous Nega Pass. In between, everything the desert has to offer would have to be dealt with, including rutted and fast-winding tracks and steep, soft dunes. Yeah, okay, this probably would be tougher than anything else I had to tackle so far. It wasn't an inviting prospect. I dragged myself out of my sleeping bag, got suited up, a challenge in itself, and quickly ate breakfast. Feeling like some kind of automaton, I crawled onto my motorcycle and rode out of the bivouac on the same road southwest of the airport to where stage 12 had ended the night before. The timing tent served as the start line for the special. It was only a 3-kilometer jaunt from the bivouac to the start, and I was wishing it was a lot longer. I needed some time to thoroughly wake up so I could concentrate on riding. I felt I was too rushed and too tired to ride with a strong enough focus to guide the Honda through the hazards I would face. Something didn't feel right. Maybe I got dressed too quickly and didn't take the time to make sure everything was fitting right. Or some clothing was bunched up, or my tool bag was loose and hanging too low. Whatever the case, I was receiving warning signs that I should have heeded. Perhaps I should have taken the time to settle down and take a different attitude towards the day. I didn't dare admit to myself that I wanted to throw in the towel. Fortunately, I couldn't give myself the right excuse to do so. There was a carrot in front of me. The end of the rally at Dakar. Only a few riders were gathered around the start area, which I thought was rather strange, because there should have been quite a few more. I didn't have much time to dwell on it, as I was directed straight up to leave. I was a few minutes late for my designated departure. It was hot, and the sun hung high in a cloudless blue sky. The course followed a rocky road set by a bulldozer blade through the flat black rocks and sand. I rode fast, but had trouble focusing on the terrain and corners. As usual, with the weight of the full fuel tanks, the bike was unwieldy, and it was a struggle to stay on two wheels. Everything was exacerbated and exaggerated by fatigue.
We've just heard To Dakar and Back by Lawrence Hacking and Will de Klerk. Readers, so much of the world to see, and even if we can't actually visit the legendary towns whose names beckon us with their magic and mystery, like Samarkand, Zanzibar, Khartoum, we've got wonderful writers to take us there, to introduce us to the people, the sights, and the sounds of each place. For more titles to keep you entertained this summer, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for traveling along with me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.